Warmer still, Monday's high around 82. Right now, 67. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andreas, 2401 16th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, I am especially excited about today's morning show because I am speaking with someone who loves books even more than I do, probably more than most of us do. And she is often affectionately known as America's librarian. I'm speaking about Nancy Pearl. And her voice is, of course, among the most eloquent of champions of books and reading and the importance of reading, the importance of libraries. And she is coming to Milwaukee on the 9th of September to talk about her first novel. That is the first novel that she herself has written, called George and Lizzie. But Nancy Pearl has a host of other books to her credit, maybe most famously a book called Book Lust and several different sequels to it in which she spells out all kinds of recommendations on books to read depending on what one is feeling in one's life, whatever you happen to be going through. There is a book that is perfect for that moment. In fact, probably a whole range of books that to which someone should maybe turn. She also has written Girl Discovers Reading, Then Discovers Life, a journal. And again, we are going to be spending quite a lot of our time talking about her new novel called George and Lizzie, but we're also going to spend plenty of time talking about the wonderful world of books and what a difference they have made in her life. She has a host of awards that are on her shelf, including being called given the Librarian of the Year award from the Library Journal. So she is very literally a librarian and the author of this remarkable new novel published by Simon & Schuster, George and Lizzie. Nancy Pearl, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm really happy to be speaking with you, and I know many listeners who listen to our sister network, Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network, know you very, very well. So this is certainly exciting for me and for many of our listeners. I do not know as much as I should about the beginning of your lifelong love affair with books, or I assume it's a nearly lifelong love affair. Is it? I mean, were you someone voraciously reading books from the very earliest age?
Yes, I grew up in a family that was not the happiest or the easiest to be in, and so from a very young age, being at home was not where I wanted to be. I didn't feel very safe there. So I spent, you know, I like to say that I spent my childhood at my local public library in Detroit. It was the Parkman Branch Library. I would go there every day after school. I would spend all day Saturday there. You know, I would be there on Saturdays. I would pack a lunch. I would eat outside under one of the trees that lined the boulevard that the library was on. And I would get there before the library opened and wait for the librarians to open the door. And then I'd still be there at 5:30 when the library closed because, you know, I didn't want to go home. And it was those librarians just particularly a librarian named Miss Frances Whitehead, who really gave me the greatest gift I think you can give someone, which is the joy, the love of reading.
As we hear that story, we might assume that for you, reading was a means of escape. Do you think that's
yes.
a good way to describe it, or was it more than that, or less than that, or not that at all?
Well, I think it certainly was a lot of that. And I think still to this day, many of us, including me, read for escape. But the other things that reading gives you are so important. And perhaps the most important of those other positive things that reading can do for you is it teaches you empathy. And, you know, I've always felt that, well, I'll speak for myself, I spend so much time in my own head and in my own body. We all do, I think. But when you're reading, you're in someone else's experience. You're walking in their shoes. And I think the more that we can get out of ourselves, you know, get out of those limitations on what we think and how we see the world and learn about the way other people respond to things and are, I think that helps us grow as human beings. I've always felt that librarians really are superheroes. We make the world a better place. And the way we do that is, in the most basic way, I think, is connecting people with books that they will enjoy.
Hmm. You say that when you're reading, you're in someone else's shoes. And I certainly agree with that, absolutely, wholeheartedly. In what way is that especially true, or maybe the most true, about reading versus, for instance, watching a great film or engaging in a heart-to-heart conversation with someone else? What is unique about reading that creates that particular experience in its own particular way?
So with reading, what you're doing as a reader, you are collaborating with the author to write the book that you're reading, in the sense that there's a wonderful novelist and essayist named Paul Auster, and he says in one of his essays that in the end, the book is created both by him and by each individual reader, because we all read a different version of the same book, you know, and this is why book clubs are so interesting to me. Because we can all be faced with the same edition, you know, we're reading it in paperback on page 47, we could read the same paragraph, but the meaning of the book changes for each person. And that act, I mean, your one's engagement in reading is really, it's an active, reading is not, it's not that you just sit back and you read. You really, I think, when a book engages you, you are an active participant in that. And I think that's different from a film, because I think a film is just sort of shoved into your face. You know, you look at a film and you can, you don't think about the characters and all of that, but you are not participating in it in the same kind of intimate way you are when you're reading a book.
Hmm. So in other words, when one watches the superb film To Kill a Mockingbird, you experience something very powerful, very moving, but in a sense, very little is left to your imagination. I mean, you see on the screen Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch. You don't imagine him in your mind in the way that when you read Harper Lee's novel, you are doing something that you don't really do when you're watching a film.
I think that's absolutely true. And one of the things, I think that the people who did the casting for the Harry Potter series were brilliant. I mean, they did a brilliant job of casting that film. And what's his name, Daniel Radcliffe, is great as Harry. But it makes me very sad that the people who are introduced to the series via the film will always see Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter rather than those people who met Harry Potter through the pages of a book and were allowed to imagine him the way they thought he was. And the same is true. Gregory Peck was a marvelous Atticus Finch. I mean, I couldn't think of anyone else who would be better. But I don't know at that. I'm sure when I read To Kill a Mockingbird, I mean, the movie had not yet been made, and I probably had a different picture of Atticus than Gregory Peck. But now we're stuck with it, for better or for worse. In this case, probably for better. But, you know, we are stuck with it.
Hmm. We're speaking with Nancy Pearl, known as America's Librarian, a very eloquent voice on behalf of the importance of books, the importance of reading, the importance of libraries. And she has just written and had published her first novel called George and Lizzie, which we will talk about very shortly. Nancy Pearl, a frequent guest of Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, is coming to Milwaukee on September 9th. In fact, she will share the stage with Kathleen Dunn on that occasion to primarily talk about her new novel, George and Lizzie, but also about other things related to books. Nancy Pearl, so as you got older, let's say into high school and thinking about college and so on, I assume your love affair with books and with reading was just as intense as ever. Through that period of your childhood, did it ever ebb and flow? I mean, were there these moments in time when softball became the big deal, or horses became the big deal, or something, or pretty much was this always front and center, first and foremost, as your primary love?
Yeah, books have always been my primary love. When I was 10, I knew that I wanted to be a librarian. I wanted to be a children's librarian, just like Miss Whitehead. And I, you know, I was one of those kids who wanted to make the world a better place, wanted to do good. And I remember consciously thinking that I can help other children, just like me, find a book that they love that will turn them into lifelong readers. You know, I think in college I read fewer books because I was much more, a lot of work that I had to do. But I have always felt that other people have lives, but I have my reading. You know, I live my life through the books that that I read, and it really never. Maybe the 2 years that I didn't read as much were the years that my daughters were born, and I know that because when I was writing one of the Book Lust books, I went through the 20th century and picked out for each year like five of the best books or five books that I enjoyed that had been published in that year. And when I got to those years that my daughters were born, it was very hard to find books that I had read. So I think I was occupied with other things. But I think I can't imagine a life without reading. And I've often felt that those people who aren't readers are not readers because someone has not taken the time to help them find a book that they will love. And that particular book for that particular person is going to be different from other. Everybody would have their own kind of gateway book, if you will.
Hmm. As you described that that project for one of your previous books of listing your five favorite books for all of these different years of the century.
Uh-huh.
It reminds me of something I hadn't thought of in a long, long, long time. But the one occasion that I got to meet my best friend's grandmother, who was a very elderly woman by that point in time, one of the things that she very proudly showed me was a pile of spiral-bound notebooks in which she had kept track through her life, through the decades, every single book that she had ever read. And I was just astounded as I saw this. And, you know, here is this woman who's even advanced age, I'm sure in her mid to upper 80s, probably by that point, but still incredibly vigorous and so sharp-minded. I mean, I saw this pile of notebooks and took a glance and realized that this lifetime spent reading was surely one reason why she was the woman she was at that point in time, still so vibrant. It made a really, really strong impression on me. I wonder, at least in certain points in your life, have you also chronicled your life as a reader in that particular way?
Well, in fact, you hit on one of the things that I most regret, which is that I did not chronicle what I read. I think every once in a while I would start listing the books that I was reading or that I remembered that I had read. But in many ways, I used those, the four book lust books, as that journal, that account of the books that I had read and most enjoyed. But, oh, I would give anything to just see that list of books that I read as a kid. And I have a very good memory still, and I remember a lot of the books. And I could, you know, I could sometimes, if I don't remember the author of a particular book that I read, say, when I was 13, I can retrace my steps in the library in my mind and go to the shelf where I found that book in my mind. But, you know, I envy you seeing that list. I love lists of the books that people have read, or book clubs. Occasionally, book clubs will send me, someone from a book club will send me the list that their book club, which had met for 30 years, all the books that they'd read and discussed. And, you know, we as readers, as a society, I think, are just so concerned about what's new and what's out, you know, just hot and there, that we forget that any book that you haven't read is a new book to you. Hmm. And, you know, that's the great gift that libraries give us, because the chances are that those older titles, which you haven't read, will be on the shelf.
You did study library science. In fact, I'm pretty sure I read you received your master's degree in library science. Yeah. I'm just curious. Once in a while, I happen to be a music professor in my other life outside of the radio station, and we often have young aspiring musicians who loved to sing in the choir who begin studying music and suddenly realize they don't really want to study it. They love singing songs, yeah. Or they don't want to be the choir director up in front. They love singing in a choir, but that doesn't mean you want to be the person up on the podium and learning all of the technique that is involved in doing that well. And of course, music's not the only discipline. There's all kinds of people who love looking at a telescope through a telescope, but then they start studying astronomy and it might be exactly what they want, but it, on the other hand, might not be at all what they thought it would be. I'm just curious, as you began actually studying in order to prepare to become a librarian, was it everything that you expected it would be? That is, I don't mean being a librarian, but the study of library science in order to become a librarian. Was that what you expected it to be, and was it something you enjoyed?
In short, no. it felt like, and I went to the University of Michigan many, 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 many years ago for graduate school to get my master's degree in library science. And the courses were really much more kind of how to, you know, how to thread, you know, when you were doing films, how to thread a projector with the film. I mean, that kind of really awful, for me, nuts and bolts. In many ways, it was kind of like you just had to get through it. You just had to do those courses and get that, at that time, MLS, and then you could be a librarian and do all that entailed, which didn't seem to have much connection with what we were learning.
Hmm. You, ultimately, of course, became a librarian, and I would be curious to know, not in every single detail, of course, but at least kind of the broad general outlines of what your career as a librarian has entailed. And I think part of why I'm asking is because I think most people have no idea of all of the possibilities that are there in terms of the kind of librarian one might be or the types of libraries in which one might work.
Yes, and let me just start that by saying that these days a library degree really, I think, opens the door to almost not only the different kinds of libraries that you could work at, you know, special libraries like law libraries or university libraries, community college libraries, public libraries. It really, an MLIS, which is what is mostly offered these days, Master of Library and Information Science, you really, you know, you learn how to build websites, and it's just amazing to me the doors that an MLIS degree will give you besides, you know, just working in a library. But for me, just working in a library was all that I wanted to do. And my degree, my first job was back at the Detroit Public Library. And, it would have been so wonderful to have been able to work with Bis Whitehead at the Parkman Branch Library. But I got to be her colleague. I was assigned to different libraries. And one of the most meaningful parts of my few years at the Detroit Public Library System was that I got to work on the bookmobile. And the bookmobile at that time went to underserved communities in Detroit, to the poorest sections, the housing projects, Brewster Douglas housing project, where we would go once a week. We brought the library to those kids who had really so little, but we could lend them books and encourage their reading. And then I found that children's books weren't complex enough for me, or something. I just got a little tired of just children's books and became an adult librarian when we moved to. Then we moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma, from Ann Arbor, from Detroit, that area, and I became a bookseller, and then a librarian, went back to the library in Tulsa, and then got offered a job in Seattle, where I ended my, you know, formal library career.
So you are no longer a librarian, is that right?
Well, no, Greg. Now, once a librarian, always a librarian. Once a music professor, always a music professor, whether you're professing in front of a class or not.
Right.
So I no longer, in 2004, which was a year after the first Booklust book came out, and I was doing a lot of workshops for libraries around the world, actually, at that time, I couldn't just, you know, have a 5-day-a-week job at the public library any longer. So I left that part of my career and kind of embarked on a new direction.
And, of course, a lot of people are glad you did. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Nancy Pearl, probably the most famous librarian in the country, I should think, maybe the world, many times over a best-selling author herself, well-known especially for her series of books titled in one variation or another, Booklust, which she's talked about all kinds of different books and all of the different possibilities. Also author of Girl Discovers Reading, Then Discovers Life, and very shortly we'll start discussing her first novel that has just been published, titled George and Lizzie. Nancy Pearl, could we talk for a moment about the old card catalogs that one used to find in libraries? And I suppose once in a while, maybe they're still there, maybe particularly in children's libraries. I'm not sure. But I miss those terribly. Do you miss them too? Or is that just a relic of the past that we just need to sort of forget about and move on from?
Well, I think the card catalog had its place. It was a wonderful way to browse. You know, you were looking through the card catalog for the book that you wanted to find. But, you know, the process of getting there to that particular card involved looking at other cards, the names of books, and that was a way of finding other things that you didn't know that you wanted to read, but oh wow, they sound so interesting. And then there was that, you know, the wonderful drawers that you could, I mean, there's something very lovely and romantic, I think, about card catalogs. And there's something, you know, again, the kind of tactile feeling of, you know, moving those cards to find the book that you were looking for, that you don't get when you're looking on a computer. One of the interesting limitations on using a card catalog, though, is that, you know, they always had subject headings for the book. You know, if it was a history of Henry VIII, they would have Tudor period with the dates, or England history with those dates. But for every subject that you added to a card, you had to type that in. You know, nobody did that. The librarian had to type all those entries in, and then you had to type them on every. You had to do a separate card for each one of those entries. So I'm sure that I said, oh, this book could have many more topics, but it's too much trouble to type them. And then retype them on the other cards. And a computer will do a much, it's much easier if you're cataloging via a computer, because it's not that much work to add as many subjects for the book as you need to make sure that people looking for that book will find it.
Right.
But the romance, you know, those card catalogs, absolutely. I mean, they just, when I was growing up, when I got my library degree, it was a wonderful time for libraries. And sometimes I just miss all that.
Right. I certainly understand what you mean. And, of course, one can have starry-eyed romantic notions about all kinds of things, including the delicious meal you just had at this wonderful restaurant, and with no thought given to the people toiling in the kitchen and who's going to wash the dishes and so on and so on. And you're reminding me that there's a lot of toil involved in the creating of those old card catalogs. But I so agree with you. Your first point was my favorite, that I especially loved, actually, although it's true even with just a subject catalog, but even more so for me, the shelf catalog, where you would flip through those cards and you were, in a sense, traveling along the shelf and seeing every book, not just the specific book for which you might be looking, but all the books before it and after it and so on. And I so wish that somebody who is in the business of creating the online catalogs that libraries use would somehow create a means to, in a sense, recreate that shelf catalog experience. I haven't seen that yet, but maybe someday it will appear, if somebody even remembers what those were like. What about the? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, it would be fun for a book that you look at to have a picture of the shelf that book is on, so that you can see the books to either side of it.
Ah, I like that a lot.
Wouldn't that be interesting? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, one can travel on the shelf too, I suppose, but nevertheless, I mean, that's one of the blessings, of course, of real books, so to speak, that is a physical book on a shelf, is that there are all of these other books around it that might grab your attention. Could we just talk for a moment about the fact that libraries are now broadening their offerings, and that books are not always quite as front and central and in some ways almost the exclusive reason for a library to exist, that all kinds of other things are offered. I suspect that you were a librarian long enough, if you were a librarian through 2004, you certainly saw some of that shift. Was that something that you fought or resisted, or did you see it as a necessary, even if maybe sad, change that, that had to happen?
I think that that the library, the public library, is really one of the last hallmarks of a small d democracy, and it was always known as the people's university. When we take away the books that have educated immigrants, you know, that immigrants use to learn about America, to become Americans, when we take away those books in favor of, another computer, another row of computers, I think we lose something. The library is the only place in our country where when you walk in the door of the library, you are equal to everyone else. It's your library. And I think that we don't often, as librarians, do a very good job of not only sort of selling what we do, but also of celebrating the way libraries form people's lives. Now, I'm all in favor of balancing what we do. I mean, there's certainly things that the library does in this in the year 2017 that are very important, and one of those is having computers available for those people who can't afford a computer at home, who need to do their homework using the internet, for example, but don't have access to that at home. Those are important. My big fear is that we will forget that other organizations, community centers, whatever, probably do have public computers, but the library is the only place that has those books.
Mm. I wonder, this is the last question before we begin talking about George and Lizzie. Thank you for your patience.
Yeah, I love it.
The question often comes up of is there a meaningful difference, significant difference, between a book you hold in your hands and a book that you read on the screen, on your
right.
Nook or Kindle or laptop or by right. whatever means. I'm curious, first of all, what your opinion is about that. Do you not see a significance that we even need to worry about, or do you think there is a real difference, and do you have a real preference yourself for one or the other?
Well, it should come as no surprise, Greg, that I still have a preference for a traditional book, a book that I can hold in my hands. I read on my electronic reader when I'm traveling. That it's very, very convenient. I find, and I don't know if I'm in a minority about this, but I find that I can't read anything serious on my Kindle because there is something very different about holding a book and seeing the color of the pages and turning the pages and being able to go back and forth with great ease. Still much easier to go back to page 5 in the book you're holding than on an e-reader. I just find that I still, if I have my choice, I will always go to the real, real book, if that's the right phrase, but I will always go to the traditional book.
The physical book.
That
sits
right,
on a
right.
shelf,
yeah.
as do I. In fact, I'm kind of intrigued when I once in a while find that I have to prepare for an interview and the physical book has not yet come in the mail, then I will
right.
I will go ahead and order it online if it's an important interview and a book I really, really want to try to read, even at the last minute. But it's so interesting, at least the thing I use on my wife's iPad to order a book, that particular program at least makes them look like physical books sitting on shelves. It's as though they realize that is an experience that most of us are still really hungry to have, even if we find ourselves conceding to this new development.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that with a book that you're reading on your e-reader, you can't see the thickness of the pages. You can't really, although you can change the typeface that you're looking at it, you don't see the typeface that the publishing company and the author chose. For example, George and Lizzie has deckled edges of the book. You know, they're not cut smoothly. If you look at most hardbound books, the pages are just smooth up and down vertically. But George and Lizzie is just beautifully deckled, and you can't see that on an e-reader. And I think that it just adds to the experience.
Right. You know, you're absolutely right. I have it right here. I'm holding it, and you're right. Just to explain to our listeners that if you run your fingers along not the spine of the book, but the sort of the opposite end of the spine, the edges of all of the pages, it's rough. It's not smooth because there is, in a sense, a deliberate imperfection in how the pages have been cut. Was it for any particular reason that you wanted that to happen?
No, in fact, I didn't even, it wasn't me, it was my editor who wanted that. I believe that she's the person who did it, who said that's what we want to do. And, I have to say, I probably never would have even thought about it because, I loved it when it was on other books, but it didn't occur to me it could be on George and Lizzie as well.
Interesting. Well, I think it fits because your novel, George and Lizzie, is about, in a sense, sort of rough and imperfect relationship between an unlikely husband and wife. And and certainly their story is rather untidy in a sense, which is what makes it fascinating. Ahead of us delving into the novel just a bit, could you say a word about what prompted you at this fairly advanced stage in your life and career, if I may say so, to write your first novel? Did anything in particular prompt you? Were you hungry for some sort of experience you hadn't yet had?
No, it wasn't that. It was that one night one morning I had foot surgery, and that very early in the day. And that night, I was taking pain medication all day for to control the pain from the surgery. And when I got into bed late that night and was trying to fall asleep, the characters, these two characters, George and Lizzie, came into my head, and I knew their names. I knew where they met. I even knew Lizzie's last name at that moment when they came to me, but I didn't know anything else of them. And over the next 3 or 4 years, really, I just thought about them all the time. And the more I thought, the more I found out about them and about their relationship and what their childhoods had been like and about their marriage. Finally, after 3 or 4 years where I had kept all this in my head, I would kind of tell the story to myself and in my head write down, in my head think of sentences and then rewrite those sentences the next day and rewrite them again. Finally, it was just all in my head, the whole thing, and I just decided that I needed to sit down and, try to get it down on paper for myself because I didn't really want to forget what I knew about them. So initially, I was really just writing down what I knew about them, and I was writing, I was discovering that I was writing the kind of book that I most love to read, you know, a kind of quirky book about interesting people, not always likable necessarily, but always understandable, a book that would have a lot of books in it and poetry and football. I love football as well. all of those things. And the characters, you know, turned out neither one, none of them are exactly anyone else that I've known in my life. But I took bits and pieces from many different people. You know, when you write your first novel at 72, you're pretty, you have a lot, you have a, like a long, many years of having met many different people. And, you know, because of my memory, what I remember always is the quirky bits of people. Like, you know, I had a boyfriend in college who could always find four-leaf clovers. I mean, he would just look at a patch of clovers and just bend down and pick up the four-leaf clover. And so I gave that talent to Lizzie's babysitter, who, you know, who, and so that kind of thing where you just take bits and pieces and give them to the characters as they fit. But for me, writing George and Lizzie was really a process of discovering their lives, discovering what had happened rather than my inventing it. It was really just uncovering them.
Right. It was as though it were already there.
And you
pulled the sheet away. One thing I really appreciate about the novel is that at a glance, at least, George and Lizzie are, as I mentioned earlier, very much an odd couple. And yet each of them is more complicated than that. I mean, they are much more than just what they appear to be on the surface, that George is this fairly safe, normal dentist who was raised by a very nice family, and Lizzie is a bit more of a wacky free spirit who was raised by intellectuals, but they are more than that. They are more than the way we would summarize them. And I think that's not always the case. I mean, there's probably entire genres in which you stick with the surface, you stick with the caricature, the stock characters. You clearly weren't interested in doing that with George and Lindsay, and George and Lizzie, or for that matter, any of the characters in your book.
Yeah, no, I wasn't. I wanted a book. I wanted a book where, you know, I wanted a book that would be good for book discussions, or you know, I wanted a book that made you think. And when you're talking about books, what you're really talking about is all the white space on the page. You're talking about what the author hasn't told you, but that they've intimated or given you a sense of. And I didn't want a book that told readers everything. I wanted that sort of active participation. And I wanted a lot of humor. You know, it's a very, in places, a very funny book. And I wanted characters who were three-dimensional. You know, one of the nicest things somebody said to me is that she felt that the characters became her best friends. You know, that was lovely.
One facet of Lizzie's life experience is that there is something she did in high school, which she calls the great game. And I don't know how much of this you want to maybe even say to our listeners, but it is something about which she ruminates constantly and feels tremendous guilt. Did anything in particular prompt you to create this particular facet and say whatever you like about it?
Right. My experience was not Lizzie's experience at all in high school.
We should say this was an extensive sexual escapade, let's say, involving many people.
Yes. She did it on a lark. She did it because she thought it would be fun. And she was very wrong. And I guess my only defense of Lizzie's actions were that I think when you're 17, you do a lot of stupid things that you think will, you know, that will, that won't affect your life, and sometimes they do. And, you know, Lizzie made, you know, really just a stupid decision and then, you know, has to live with the consequences.
Mm. There's a
I was just going to say, and she never forgives herself for that.
Absolutely, and that has a lot to do with, in a sense, who she is. There's an interesting point in the book where I believe it's Lizzie who is reflecting on the strange list of things that she remembers from her life. And and this list that she sort of forms for herself goes on for pages. And it's absolutely fascinating. And it made me realize that, I've thought of the same thing many times myself. About the strange things we remember. It's one of my favorite parts of the book. There's another neat part where she gets I guess it would be kind of a Dear John letter or whatever you call it, but a boyfriend is breaking up with her, someone with whom she has studied poetry extensively, and her reaction to that, she vents her anger by going through that letter with a red pen, and explain what she does.
Right. Yes, I loved doing that section. That was really fun, and I loved that the fact that Lizzie did it, that she wrote this letter. She wrote this letter pretending she was the boy who had broken up with her, and explained in the letter why he broke up with her. That she got the whole idea for doing that because she was walking home from class one day at the University of Michigan, and she heard. You know, it was an Indian summer, and she heard that that song, "I'm Going to Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter and Make Believe It Came From You." And, you know, that clicked in her head. And I thought, oh, wow, what a great idea that is. And then did the letter as though it came from Jack. and then had Lizzie comment on it in capital letters. Everything that he said wrong, or everything she objected to that he said.
Yeah, it's really, really a great moment. It helps us. It helps bring her alive to us, and all that sort of stirring around in her soul. And of course, one last quick question: you have chosen to alternate, I would say, rather wildly between different times. Was there a particular reason you wanted to do that? I'm glad you did it. It makes the book interesting, but is that the only reason you did it?
No, I did it because that was basically the order in which I wrote down, in which I took what was in my head and wrote it down. Isn't that strange? I mean, when my editor, you know, got the book and we were starting to talk about it, and you know, I wasn't sure what order it should be in. And, you know, she had some great ideas, and we switched some things around. But basically, that's the order. The order that you're reading is the order that I wrote those sections.
Fascinating. Well, it makes me want to go back and read the book again and then kind of have a sense of how this unspooled for you in your rich, imaginative mind. At any rate, our listeners have the opportunity to meet you and to learn much more about this, your debut novel, George and Lizzie. It's a fascinating book, and wonderfully crafted. And you will be appearing at Boswell Books in Milwaukee. That's 2559 North Downer on the 9th of September at 7 p.m. And Nancy Pearl, I'm not sure I can put into words just how much I have enjoyed this opportunity to finally speak with you and to talk about something that you and I and many of the people listening right now share in common, a love of books. Very best wishes to you with all that stretches ahead, and thank you for making time for the morning show today.
Well, thank you, Greg. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I am very pleased to be welcoming into our studios Debbie Ford, who is the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And we will be talking with her about a number of things, including the exciting new partnership between Parkside and SC Johnson. Next Tuesday, I'm excited to share with you several different interviews that I will be recording with several different residents of Houston, talking about the chaos and damage caused by Hurricane Harvey. I will be speaking with two different Carthage College graduates, former students of mine, and also the former Tech